Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's talk is from the Dhammapada. It's called the Bhikkhu Vagga, or meaning to a monk, to a bhikkhu. And the whole theme of this sutta, rather short sutta, is restraint. And so that's a running theme through the Buddha's Dhamma and a running theme through our classes, isn't it? That ultimately, the Dhamma is a practice of wise restraint and knowing how to apply it and where to apply it. And the Buddha is very clear about where to apply it. It's that life as life occurs. And our relationship to what's occurring in the outside world is obviously through our five physical senses and the sixth sense of consciousness, ongoing thinking. And so if that thinking is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that will be a mind that's always grasping after, always wanting more of something or having aversion or less of something. And so obviously and directly you can see that restraint is the counter to a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths and always wanting more or wanting less. Either one is an aspect. Wanting less is not restraint. Wanting less is aversion. It's I don't want something to happen to me. It's not what we're talking about. Excuse me. So this is the key to the Dhamma. And if you understand the framework of the Dhamma, you'll see this as a complete Dhamma practice. And Kim, just so you understand a little bit about what we're talking about, I know this is all new to you. The Buddha taught Four Noble Truths. They're noble truths in that these four truths relate directly to awakening as a human being. Other things that are true, such as the sky is blue and my dog is white, are true, but they have no relation to the Dhamma, so they're not noble truths. And we don't have to be concerned about them or worry about establishing them or holding on to them. What we want to do is develop understanding of these four truths, and that's where restraint comes in. Bhikkhu Vagga, from the 25th chapter of the Dhammapada. The Buddha's words. Skillful is restraint at the eye, at the ear, at the nose, and at the tongue. Simple and direct, isn't it? Where and how we encounter the world is where we practice restraint. When you think about the obviousness of that statement, it makes perfect sense, but a mind that's rooted in ignorance might have trouble grasping, where do I apply the Dhamma? It's right there at the point of contact. The Buddha continues. Skillful is restraint at the body. Skillful is restraint in speech. Skillful is restraint in thought. It's an interesting line, isn't it? Most people would never even think about purposely restraining their thought. But again, it's a mind rooted in ignorance, prone to greed, aversion, and deluded thinking that is always grasping after another deluded thought. It's greed. There's no restraint there. In fact, the simple act of meditation, excuse me, you often hear me say that jhana meditation is both a metaphor and a practical experience of the Dhamma. And in the way that we recognize that we're caught up in our thoughts and come back to the sensation of breathing, that's interrupting the process of ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. It's interrupting that thought process. That's restraint. And it's direct and it's direct and mindful when we do it, because we're doing it within the framework of the Eightfold Path. I notice an aspect of ignorance arising in me. And I notice it because of the feeling and the thought attached to it. I want more of something. I want less of something. I've lost my mind over something. I'm stuck in fear. I take a breath. And in that moment, what we established on our cushion, that's restraint. It's restraint on our cushion, and when we find ourselves stuck in a situation off our cushion, we all have learned to do the same thing as that baby Kim, is to take a breath and reunite our mind and our body, and there is no stress in that aspect of life well restrained. Another way of saying that is life well concentrated. It's the same thing in this aspect. The Buddha continues. Restraint in all experiences is skillful. A mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths doesn't want to hear that. this is another interesting line. One restrained in the world is free from confusion, delusion, and disappointment. One restrained in the world. That's a statement of ultimate responsibility. One restrained in the world is free from confusion, delusion, and disappointment. Why am I emphasizing this? Matt, do you know? It's a little bit obscure. Restrained in the world.
Well, we talked about that earlier about where do we practice restraint? At the point of contact. So when we encounter the world through our senses, we're going, what encounters the world is a view of ourself that's encountering the world. Yeah. So we personalize what comes through our sense gate.
Yeah.
And then now it's about me, mine, whether I like it, whether I don't like it, I have a preference of it, I disapprove of it. Those are the things that we've identified with as me and mine. So if things are me and mine, then there's not me and not mine. And I'm going to be disappointed when I don't get what I want or I get what I don't want. So all of those things are involved in practicing restraint.
Yes.
And when we can practice restraint, we are mindful of what's coming through our senses and not personalizing them.
Yep.
And when we don't personalize what comes through our senses, we're not confused by what comes through our senses.
We're not confused.
We're not disappointed by what comes through our senses. We're not distracted by what comes through our senses because we know that it's just phenomena arising.
Yeah, nothing personal.
Nothing personal.
So, that beautiful explanation. The world here is simply a reference to the three marks of existence, isn't it? The impermanence of all things, and the misunderstanding of self, and the stress and suffering that follows from that. That's the world. That's what the Buddha is referencing. But one who has practiced restraint in that worldly environment, those who have full control of their, the Buddha continues, those who have full control of their hands, their feet, and their tongue are delighted with their understanding. They are well established in meditative absorption. The Buddha is saying, if you want to develop this type of practice, you have to establish, meditative absorption is another word for jhana. You have to establish jhana. They are well established in meditative absorption. They are content in solitude. We don't need constant stimulation. We don't need constant distraction. The sign of an awakened human being or an awakening human being is the establishment of ever more aspects of solitude. And remember, an aspect of solitude doesn't mean alone. It simply means that you're disentangled from the world. So you could be at a protest or a riot. And if your mind is well restrained, you are disentangled from the world. You're not stuck in the world again. And that's really the point of the Dhamma. When the Buddha is referring to solitude, he's referring to the most basic aspect of solitude in jhana meditation, but he's also talking about the solitude that is established within our own minds. Sometimes the Buddha would refer to that as the ultimate protection or the ultimate safety from the dangers that are out in the world. They are content in solitude, free of entanglements. They are called Dhamma practitioners. So if we're wondering what a Dhamma practitioner is content in solitude and free of entanglements with the world. Those who have control of their tongue are moderate in speech. Unassuming, they explain the Dhamma with integrity and by example. Jen explained that and exampled that beautifully before. Their words are useful and pleasing. Those that abide in the Dhamma, who delight in the Dhamma, are mindful of the Dhamma. They do not lose the Dhamma. Those free of aversion of what has occurred to them, and free of craving for what has occurred to others, will be able to attain meditative absorption. I have to read that line because that's another one of those lines. This is the whole Dhamma right here. Those free of aversion of what has occurred to them, and free of craving for or wanting, free of craving for what has occurred to others, will be able to attain meditative absorption. Another way of saying that is no matter what occurs in your life, as your life unfolds, you don't take anything personal. What's happening to me or what's happening to other people. Somebody wins a big pot of gold, That's wonderful for them, but I don't see anything, any reflection in me. So the reflection isn't, well, they're such wonderful people, they deserve it, because that's a self-referential view, isn't it? Me as opposed to them. It's just an acknowledgement of life as life occurs. There's big pots of gold that fall on people all the time, as well as bricks and mortars fall on people all the time. It can be seen as one is preferable to another, but none of it is personal. And that's the point. That's what the Buddha's teaching here. We will be able to attain meditative absorption. Those that are calm, even when receiving little, pure in livelihood and determined in their Dhamma practice, are exalted by the wise. That was a line that helped me understand right livelihood. Because when I first came to the Dhamma, I thought, doesn't right speech and right action, cover right livelihood? In other words, if I'm mindful of right speech and right action, isn't right livelihood good to go? Until I realize that otherwise good and honest people, when it takes time to put food on a table for the kids, might stretch that a little bit. Might even steal a little bit or lie a little bit to put that food on the table. That's fine if you do it, but you're not practicing the Dhamma and you're creating stress and suffering for yourself and others when you do so. And that's the kind of purity that resides in the Dhamma. We can't make any excuses. And the Buddha's saying that right here. With little, when they receive little, but they're pure in livelihood. When you think about the conditions during the Buddha's time, there were many classes of people in northern India. And the lowest of the low was pure hell. The other two classes weren't much better. But the Buddha recognized that and taught towards that. And rather than carry on with the PC talk of the time, that only certain people could learn certain things, you had to be part of a certain class, and women couldn't learn anything valuable, nothing. Certainly, and spiritual teachers were considered valuable. The person that would teach a woman in that case would be killed, would be put to death. This is where the Buddha taught, and he taught everyone. He never excluded one person from his Sangha. And so when you think about this, he's teaching the poor of the poor who are now sitting in front of them and immediately giving them value in themselves because of what they're doing. Because no matter how poor you are, no matter what you're lacking, you can always develop a pure mind and a pure heart. That's what the Buddha's saying here. So put all the worldly conditions aside. It doesn't matter. The Dhamma can be practiced. Who receive little, pure in livelihood, and determined in their Dhamma practice are exalted by the wise. Those with no clinging to thoughts or feelings. Notice the Buddha's not saying not clinging to gold or friends or position. Those with no clinging, with no clinging to thoughts or feelings, free of regret from what is not present, they are true Dhamma practitioners. Free of regret from what is not present, what I don't have, what I can't add to me to make me better or bigger. Those who abide with compassion for all beings and devoted to the Dhamma will achieve unbinding, meaning awakening, and the bliss of cessation of all conditioned thinking. It's another important line. Those who abide with compassion for all beings. Notice the Buddha's not stopping there. Compassion for all beings and devoted to the Dhamma will achieve unbinding and the bliss of cessation of all conditioned thinking. Even during the Buddha's time, there was something called engaged Buddhism, meaning that if you were just engaged in something that was so-called spiritual, you were good to go. That was your compassionate practice. Or maybe even protesting against something, against that women can't be allowed into the original Sangha. That was seen as compassionate. The Buddha's saying it's not compassion at all if it's not married with Dhamma, with understanding, with wisdom. Compassion without wisdom is often hurtful. And there's so many good examples of that today. There's a lot of well-meaning people that are creating incredible pain for other people. I think the prevailing mental illness in the world, if people would look at it, is a severe messiah complex, because that's what people are saying. That people are taking the position that I know what's best for everyone. I'm the savior of the world. You need to follow me. And again, I'm going to be careful. It's not just one person that's saying that. It's millions and millions of people are taking that role of the savior. And it's creating a lot of pain and suffering in the world, because none of us can be saviors. and none of us can be saved. In fact, you could say when you understand the Dhamma, the world can't be saved. The world is the world. And it will always be what it is. It will always be an aspect. And there's this line in here that touches on this. The world will always be what human beings make it. Empty of all conditioned thoughts, free of craving and aversion, they achieve unbinding. Free of craving and aversion, they achieve unbinding. Abandon the five lower fetters of self-referential views, of doubt, of belief in rites and rituals, of lust and of ill will. Lust is another word for craving. Abandon conceit, restlessness, and ignorance, and abandon the fetters of craving to establishing a self in heavenly realms. That's 90% of modern practices, aren't heavenly realms. We got to get to heaven because life sucks. You just lost your life, didn't you? When that's your plan for living, is I want to get to heaven. As opposed to, I want to learn how to live each and every moment in a meaningful way. And that's what the Buddha teaches us. In heavenly realms or formless realms, cultivate the skillful faculties of conviction, persistence, refined mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Overcoming the fetters, one has crossed to the far shore of lasting peace and happiness. Develop concentration through meditation. Do not be heedless. Excuse me. Do not be heedless and allow your mind to be distracted by sensual desire. The world's bait is like a red-hot ball of iron. Do not swallow it and then cry how painful it is, like a red-hot ball of iron. There is no concentration for those that fail to develop insight. Remember the class we went through last week, or last summer, that 37 class on Vipassana, true introspective insight. That's the insight that the Buddha is referring to. And it's a very specific introspective insight into the world, as mentioned earlier, into the three marks of existence. There is no insight for those that fail to develop concentration. Those who have developed through the Eightfold Path, concentration and insight in tandem are close to nibbana, are close to awakening. Concentration and insight into the three marks of existence. The Buddha continues, those who abide in solitude, free of worldly entanglements, with a calm mind, who understand the Dhamma through tranquility and insight, in them arise delight that transcends all human delight. It's the greatest gift. Those that see with true insight the rise and the fall of all conditioned things and of the five clinging aggregates, they are full of joy and lasting happiness. This is called the deathless state, as there will be no rebirth of confusion, delusion, and disappointment. That's the deathless state, as opposed to immortality. And why is that so important? The Buddha constantly refers to being free of ignorance as the deathless state and living in ignorance as living like as life as a living death. And it is, isn't it? Because a mind rooted in ignorance is distracted to the next life or at least the next thing, the next moment, because right here isn't good enough for me. And you've just lost your life. The only way to live and have a human life is to be present for it moment by moment as life arises, as life occurs. We have a mind united with a body. That mind has to be present with life as life occurs to actually be experience your life, doesn't it? And if there's any greed that takes you out of this moment for what I need, or any aversion that takes you out of this moment for what I hope to avoid, you've now lost your mind and you've lost your life in that moment. Everybody follow that? I think you do, right? Restraint of the senses, restraint of the senses, contentment in the Dhamma, and restraint of unskillful behavior, these form the foundations of a well-integrated life. Associate with those who are engaged in the noble search, who have passion for the true Dhamma, who are pure in thought, word, and deed, who are pleasant and refined in their behavior. Full of joy, unbinding will occur. Just as a jasmine creeper sheds its withered flowers, so should you shed greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Those well-composed, calm and pleasant in thought, word, and deed, free of worldly entanglements, can be truly known as serene. the sage of peace. It is by self-understanding that one can scrutinize themselves and restrain themselves through self-understanding. With a sixth sense base, well guarded, with refined mindfulness. I got to go back to that one line because I wanted to make a point of it and I forgot. It is by self-understanding that one can scrutinize themselves and restrain themselves through self-understanding. So I can pray all I want or anybody else might want for God to not let me do this next thing, and it's not going to happen, isn't it? If it does, it's not because of, according to a mind understanding of Dhamma, it's not because of God, it's because I practice restraint. And if I constantly rely on prayer to control my own behavior, what have I done? I've lost my mind. I've taken all responsibility for my own well-being and happiness and given it off to an idea. That's what drove the Buddha to seek understanding. It didn't make sense to him, and it never made sense to me, even though that's what I was told. And what the Buddha awakened to wasn't a lack of intervention from other worldly creatures. It was a lack of understanding of this world, the three marks of existence, of this world. We're not trying to develop an understanding of where I might be. We're trying to develop an understanding of where I am. That's restraint.
John.
Yes.
I was kind of surprised to see that word scrutinize here. When I looked into it a little bit further, I realized that it kind of refers to that line in the Karaniya Metta Sutta where he says, do not do the slightest thing that the wise yes. may later reprove.
Yeah.
That kind of scrutiny of your own motivations.
Yes.
Where you look at them carefully, and it's not like that you're berating yourself all the time,
yep.
but you examine it carefully so that you're not going astray.
Yes, yes. Thank you. I mean, that's so important. That's pure Dhamma. Another way that I often say what Ram just explained and scrutinized is, what is the word I do? I can't think of it. Wow.
Disarmament?
No. it's a word that fits me not recognizing it. Recognition. Recognition and abandonment is that process that the Buddha is referring to as scrutinize. We have this framework, a well-developed, well-concentrated mind, and a framework on which to see things that can be characterized as right view. And it's through that right view that I'm scrutinizing my behavior so that I can recognize and abandon that behavior that is contrary to the Dhamma. But I do it myself.
There's also something that I heard right before that kind of qualified the scrutiny as saying, like, the only way to effectively scrutinize.
Yes.
Whereas, so if you're scrutinizing without the framework of the Eightfold Path, you're not actually being wise.
Yes.
There was something else in there that's how I heard it, kind of.
Yes, it's exactly that way. Right. So this is another one of those suttas. The Buddha doesn't come out and say, you must practice the Eightfold Path. But what you're all hearing and what you're referring to is he's always coming back and pointing us to the path. Mm-hmm. It's through this path that we're able to scrutinize ourselves. If you don't care about understanding who you are and abandoning those things that are causing so much confusion, frustration, stress, and suffering in your life, the Dhamma is useless, isn't it? But if you want to understand who you are, if you want to develop what the Buddha taught as disentangled from the world and a constant, calm, and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring, you develop the Dhamma. And this is how you do it. These are direct instructions. I said, I think on Saturday's class, that up until the last few classes, these suttas that I've chosen have been more or less in theory. And these closing suttas are what it looks like. And that's just what this is. This is what Dhamma practice looks like. This is how we practice it.
John, isn't that the difference between willpower and right restraint?
Exactly. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, it is. Because we can, I kind of referenced it before. willpower could be I'm praying to God that I don't do something I don't want to do, and yet I go ahead and do it. I did that. I started praying when I was a little boy, and most of it had to do with I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to punch that guy in the nose. Oh, I'm punching on that, and I hit one person my whole life. But I'm making a point. All the things that I prayed about, I don't think I ever got one thing that I ever prayed about. Maybe I did. But it never did anything for my behavior, which I thought was curious, because even the thought, you would think that psychologically just creating a thought in my mind, even though it was focused on something magical, that the thought itself would help restrain my behavior, but it never did. I mean, I used to wonder about that, and I'd blame myself. Well, I'm just such an awful person that God's not going to do anything for me. I didn't say enough Hail Marys or whatever that is, and that stuck with me for a while until I realized that's kind of silly. And then I encountered the Dhamma, and I started realizing how much of my thinking, probably from the day I was born until that moment, 30 some odd years later, I literally hated myself. I kept finding out things that I did were wrong, that I needed to change, that I'll never be good enough about. And it was reinforced by the world. Three marks of existence. But not because of a conspiracy against me, because of other ignorant minds that were reinforcing my own ignorance. That's the problem with ignorance, isn't it? It's its own self-fulfilling prophecy. But with wise restraint and the proper amount of scrutiny, the point of this little speech, with the proper amount of scrutiny, right view, informed scrutiny, I can recognize what I'm doing to myself. And I can stop blaming other situations and worldly conditions for how I feel and how I think. And in that way, I can gain true human maturity. I can wake up. With the sixth sense base well guided, with refined mindfulness, one will always live in peace and happiness. The Buddha's words from 2600 years ago: be your own protector, be your own refuge. What other refuge could there be? What other refuge could there be than ourselves as individuals developing our understanding of who we are in relation to the world? What other refuge could there be but understanding? Restrain yourself as a river restrains, as a rider restrains his horse. Full of joy and conviction in the Dhamma, the peaceful state is developed and conditioned. I get a little tired and I can't read anymore, but I'm going to try and finish this. Full of joy and conviction in the Dhamma, the peaceful state is developed and conditioned thinking ends. Conditioned thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Those that develop the Dhamma illuminate the entire world as a bright moon free of clouds. I love that line, so I'm going to say it once more. Those that develop the Dhamma illuminate the entire world as a bright moon free of clouds. That's the end of the sutta, end of the chapter. Thank you. As a bright moon free of clouds. Why am I taking that off? So just a very, very simple chapter from the Dhammapada, but pointing to the importance of using the framework of the Eightfold Path as our constant Dhamma practice. Let's go to Jane. Jane, how are you?
I'm good, John. Thank you. Wow, there was a lot in there.
Yeah.
Now, I can relate to what you were saying about, being miserable, trying to please other people, looking for things outside of myself, and looking for relief outside of myself, and yeah. How the Dhamma brings it in. It's self-responsibility. Mm-hmm. So.
It's all that. Thank you, Jane. Good evening, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing fine, John. Thank you.
Nice to see you tonight.
Glad I'm here. Yeah.
What did you think of tonight's talk?
Well, I would just echo what Jane said. I love the line, be your own protector, be your own refuge. Yep. What else is there? What's the refuge is there?
Yeah.
Simple thought, such a true thought, but it's something that almost never occurs to anyone.
Yeah, that's right. And all the freedom in the world is there. All the freedom in the world. I mean, that's it. And it makes sense, doesn't it? You know, how else could it be? So, thank you, Ed. Good evening, Josh.
Hi, John. How you doing? Hello, everybody.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
I'm struggling a little bit with the word restraint. And I know it's within the context of the Eightfold Path that we just, and I get sometimes, you know, in the point of contact of our perceptions, does that mean that we put things in its right size? Is that another word of restraint?
Yes, and ultimately, thanks for the question, Josh. It shows an insight into the Dhamma, or the question wouldn't have been phrased correctly. So how do I say this? A mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is always seeking to establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. It's a constant, ongoing struggle in order to do that in the world. That's really what stress is. And so that's the ultimate aspect of craving, is for continued self-establishment. So the restraint of mind in the moment is not so much the object that we might not be bringing into our life. It's really restraint of thought, to not constantly be engaging in thought that is seeking to establish itself rooted in ignorance. And so that's the ultimate application of restraint. So even at the thought of at the point of contact is not just physical contact. It's as I'm contacting my thoughts is the subtle aspect of restraint. And that's what takes a ever deepening level of concentration to get to that point. But does that answer your question?
Well, we're on the way.
Yeah, so it's ultimately that. A self-referential ego personality does not like the word restraint. There's always an initial reaction. I don't want to hear that, because that mind is always grasping after more. But if you think about, put the Dhamma aside, the most practical way of living in the world would be with wise restraint, wouldn't it be? Instead of always grasping after more. The Buddha teaches a way to develop that within the framework of right view, so that there's no tension left in practicing wise restraint. It's simply an aspect of who you are. There's no second thought about it either. Maybe that's a bad word to use. Some of the difficulty with restraint is, I can't give up all restraint. How can I, or I can't give up all grasping. What's going to happen to me? It feels like annihilation. When the truth of the matter is, once we let go of all grasping, then we are finally free, like we touched on earlier. So, thank you, Josh. Rob, how are you tonight? Where are you?
I'm here. This is the second time, I think, that we've gone through this part of Dhammapada. We did it in the Insight series last year.
Yeah.
And that time I found this particular one a bit rambling. And now that I've read it again, it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
It takes the idea of restraint and goes through it in little pictures.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of practical things in there. It's like my head popped up. That those free of aversion what has occurred to them and free of craving what has occurred to others. It's like, I've never heard this before.
Yeah.
It is so practical. This is day to day greed and aversion.
Yeah, that's right.
Day to day. And it's about what you think of yourself and how you see others and things like jealousy and all that. And it comes up in this beautiful little sentence.
Yeah.
I used to have a problem with the Dhammapada, and I'm starting to like it more and more. I'm looking forward to the coming series of the Dhammapada.
Yeah. I think it really is a remarkable book. I'm looking forward to it too. But the Dhamma is like that, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That you Ram has shown great persistence in keeping up with the Dhamma, even when aversion like that would arise, mm-hmm. not now, but in the past. Recognize it as such and keep doing it. And now this, like you said, this is just a beautiful little chapter, where at one time it was annoying.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's how the Dhamma is. You know, we just have to stay with it, and it develops like that. Thank you, Ron. Kevin, how are you?
Doing well. Nice to see everybody. I liked what Josh was saying there about restraint, or what we were sort of talking about. And ultimately, you know, restraint of thought, restraint at the, you know, as we work towards that and understand where that is put to size, as Josh said, that's what we hear often. The Buddha talks about the ultimate release, the unbinding, the experience of cessation. That's what restraint is, right? I mean, we feel the release of clinging and craving. And like you were saying, Ram, the scrutiny, I liked how we sort of use that. And that's, to me, I was thinking of the word acknowledge, act on knowledge. We act accordingly within the Dhamma because we know better. We restrain the horse, right? I mean, if you have a long ride on a horse, you probably don't want it bucking around too much and taking you off the trail, right? Yeah. So we're going to be really watching how the senses and what we take in through the world, where does it ultimately end up? It ends up in our mind. Yeah. And that's where we have the control. That's where we have the freedom. That's why we keep doing this. And that's there couldn't be anything more inspiring. Again, as we said, that's the ultimate refuge. No matter what's happening out there, we can fix it with calm, clear mind. And how is that embodied? With the breath in between our thoughts.
Yeah, just like that. Thank you, wise teacher. Kim, how are you? Let me get you on a...
It's all right to do that.
There you are. It's a little weird talking to a guy like this, isn't it?
No, am I supposed to do this with my hands?
No. Yeah, oh, yeah, you have to. No, you
can't.
No,
if you don't.
You don't have to do that. and by the way, that's not a rite or a ritual. In this room, it's just a sign of respect to people. But don't feel you need to do anything.
Okay. Well, I want to respect you.
thank you, Kim. How was your meditation first?
Both difficult and exhausting.
20
difficult,
minutes.
Difficult to concentrate, but then kind of hard to stay awake at the end.
it's just like that. 20 minutes is a long time for a first sit. I suggest if you're going to continue with the practice to start with shorter periods of time, maybe even 5 minutes or even less than that, and do that twice a day. And then if you can be part of our Sangha, Tuesday classes and Saturday classes. And on my website, there's hundreds of suttas like this and 700 talks and 600 videos that you can listen to. Have you been to...
You don't have to listen to all of it once.
Thanks.
Yes, you do. No, not at once. Not even ever. Have you been to becoming-buddha.com? On that website, there's, and you'll see on the front page, there's guided meditations from 5 to 45 minutes. You can download just like we did here. I would suggest you start with 5 minutes. And if you can do that twice a day, that's great. On that same homepage, you'll see a welcome screen. Click on that and it'll give you a background on what we're doing here and why. And if you continue to be interested, just keep coming to classes and you'll develop a calm, peaceful mind like the rest of us, I think.
Thanks.
Do you have any questions or comments about your first class here?
No.
Okay. Well, welcome to our Sangha.
Thank you.
Nice. Hey, Matt.
Hey, John. Hey, everybody. Hey, everybody online. Good to see everybody. Good to hear everybody. One of the things, again, I just want to come back to what Josh's question there, because that was good, and what Kevin said was good. You know, that when we recognize that we're not right-sized, we recognize heedless, that we've become heedless in our thought, word, and deed.
Yep.
So the act of restraint is in relationship with heedlessness.
Yep.
And it's restraint itself is not a violent kind of a thing. It's in direct relationship with heedlessness.
Yeah.
And when we want to become right-sized, we have to recognize our heedlessness in our view, in our intent, in our speech, in our action, in our livelihood, in our effort, in our mind. You know, these are the things that are part of the path. So just wanted to echo that.
Thank you. That's absolutely right. David, how are you tonight?
Evening. And then you just roll back to the three jewels and the examples of all that came before us and the Sangha around us and the teachings, that even though you have to self-scrutinize, you have those examples.
Yep.
So I find it reassuring that when there's doubt, others before us had doubt and they awoken. So,
thank you. Well said. The practice itself is a completely impersonal and individual practice, but we can't do it without other persons, can we? We need a Sangha that's well-focused as well. We're fortunate to have it. Thank you, Dave. Hello, Brett.
Hey, how are you? Good to be here. Good to hear everybody. Taking responsibility, like when you say that, it's kind of funny because I've always put it off on different areas of my life, and you know, I think I take responsibility, but then sometimes I'm like, do I really? And I think we have that ability. I'm trying to do that more and more, and being aware of that, and the point of restraint. I think that's where I'm getting caught up now, is the establishment of like your ego self with, I guess, with thought. So it's being able to just, you know, you want to awaken, and then it's like you get caught up in that thought process, and it's like, well, that's what's stopping you from awakening or coming, you know. So it's tricky, and it's, you know, then I get caught in the struggle of, oh, well, you got to do this, and then it's like, well, just come back to your breath, and then that's it.
Yeah, it is it, but our minds get caught up, and it's got to be more than just that. It can't be that simple.
Yeah,
I mean, what we're really telling ourselves is that I must be more complicated than this.
Well, that's what I meant.
But we're not complicated at all, are we? We're six property people. Everyone is exactly the same in that way. So then what separates us as far as a Dhamma is concerned is what we're holding in mind. And if what we're holding in mind cannot stand up to scrutiny, how's that for a line? Then it must be abandoned. Yeah. And I would say that that's exactly what you're describing and what you've been doing. You know, is this practice of scrutinizing or recognizing and abandoning it. Yeah. And as we continue, we always have to be gentle with ourselves. I forgot to tell you, Kim, the most important thing in this practice is what?
Be gentle with yourself.
Be gentle with yourself.
Don't crack my neck.
If that's up to you to decide if that's being gentle. I don't know. I do it.
It feels better. That's gentle.
Yeah, if that's, I think I crack every joint. You should hear me wake up in the morning. Yeah. About 100 different cracks. So, Kevin, how are you? Oh, I got to you. Julie, how are you?
Hi, John. Hi, everybody. My favorite line is be your own protector and be your own refuge. And also restrain yourself as a rider restrains his horse. This past couple of days, I had a second interview. And I'm old enough that I've gone many times, but I became so stressed out. And I became so self-referential, like criticizing myself, scrutinizing myself in the wrong way, not through the Eightfold Path, and where I actually felt like I was taming a wild tiger.
Yeah.
I had to constantly remind myself, take a breath. I constantly had to take more than one breath to calm myself, because I was giving myself anxiety attacks for no reason. I had the interview already. It's already done, and it's over. I knew that was going to be an impermanent thing. It was going to be quick and done, you know. But I beat myself up, and was this was an example. To read this was a good one, because for me, it's something you need to hear that it is. It's like it is when he says restrain yourself, as a rider restrains his horse. It's really true. That's how you have to be sometimes. Yep. With your mind. You have to be vigilant with it. You have to be persistent with it. You have to also be mindful and, you know, use concentration and wisdom so that you can tame that brain of yours and bring peace again to yourself. Wow. So lots of jhana meditations, lots of little meditations, even 5-minute meditations between all that. So I must have meditated like 100 times just to stop myself. But I finally was able to restrain myself once it was over.
Yeah. Isn't that outstanding, Julia, that you had the tools and you used them?
Exactly.
That's dumb.
So it's a good example. The stress that I, you know, is also a good example to me that I know that the Dhamma works. It works.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's so important to notice it in your life, that it's actually bearing fruit. So. Good for you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, John.
And the metaphor of the horse and the rider.
I love that.
So jhana meditation are the reins on the horse. That's what we use to hold the horse back. And we're doing the same thing with our minds. Again, a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths doesn't want anything to do with concentration, especially ongoing concentration, meaning in all aspects of life. You might get that mind to concentrate on poker or golf or something else, but to take that well-concentrated mind and apply it to every aspect of life is the big challenge, but it's certainly doable, and you're describing it well. Thanks, Julia.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Hello, Michael.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody.
Michael.
That's the official Sangha haircut, by the way.
Front view, back view, side view.
Yeah, your awakening is assured for you, Michael. That's all we know.
I have a razor at home. I could help anyone out.
Michael always offers it to me.
While you're sleeping, you might wake up. Where was I now? Restraint. Initially, restraint. Right? Recognition. Recognition then. And then from that recognition, in that moment, refined mindfulness comes into play. And refined mindfulness is the Eightfold Path. What do I do? What do I do at that point? And that's holding in mind the Eightfold Path.
Yep.
We restrain ourselves, recognize, and then that recognition leads us into refined mindfulness, which is the Eightfold Path, and then we go forward from there.
Yeah, that's it.
That's what I see.
Thank you. That's Dhamma practice. Jen, did I get you? I don't think so.
No. Josh's question really got just framed this whole discussion. Nice job, Josh.
Good job, Josh.
Josh.
I was thinking about how restraint, my idea of restraint has changed through as my practice has deepened, and how initially when I initially began my practice, restraint just meant meditate, remind myself in my day-to-day to come back to my breath, you know, understand the Dhamma, go to Sangha class, and then, you know, maybe I would use it to apply it to a problem that I was having or an issue that I had in my daily life, or at a time when I recognized that I was very stressed and, you know, didn't like how I was feeling. But then, you know, as your practice deepens, you begin to see that restraint is something that you practice all the time.
Yeah.
And at moment to moment to moment. And I'm not going to keep repeating what everybody else said, but yeah, it's recognize and abandon wrong thought, word, and deed. When you recognize you're in wrong view, enter and remain in right view. And so So yeah, that's just what I was thinking about. Come on. I'm good. Yeah, thank you,
everybody. You're
working. Yeah,
you.
One more thing for Josh that I have to.
I don't know if
you
can hear us. Hopefully,
you
can.
Well, hopefully, you can. And you know, when we're talking about phenomena arising, that's when it's helpful to recall the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. This is not me. This is not mine.
Yeah.
This is not who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings us back again to the Salata Sutta, sticking the second arrow in. That's restraint, right? The world is going to have stress. We have the practice, the teachings, and the Sangha to protect from that and not stick that second arrow in. That's what restraint might be useful as well.
That's the whole point of it. Thank you, Kelly. What Jen was saying, that initial...
You're driving it home for me, man. I love it.
The initial restraint that...
Clean up.
The initial restraint that Jen was describing in her beginning practice, that's Dhamma practice. She used the Dhamma to overcome an almost unnoticeable level of aversion to simply sitting or simply coming to class.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in Jen's experience, that restraint was, okay, I don't really feel like doing it, but I'm going to sit because I want the benefit. I don't really feel like going out tonight, but I'm going to Sangha because I want the benefit. That's right effort. That's described as a Buddha by right effort too. It takes that kind of determination, you know. But and everything, every aspect that Jen just described was practical. You know, just, I notice it, I recognize it, I scrutinize it, and I let it go. I come back to the sensation of breathing. And so what's left, when we engage in Dhamma practice as intended, authentically, as it was originally presented, you can say that it's a great deal of undoing or letting go of things. And not really acquiring anything except the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, any human being with a normal IQ, let's say, you know, I'm saying it doesn't take a great intellect to sit down, read the Eightfold Path, and eventually understand what it says. And that's Dhamma practice. Any human being can do it. So then why doesn't everybody just take to the Dhamma? With all the stress and suffering in the world, you'd think that people would look for something that actually bears fruit, doesn't it? But it haven't. They haven't in 2,600 years.
Because of ignorance.
And there's one other aspect of that. I bet you know, Kevin, but it might just not be apparent to you right now. What do we do with ignorance? We cling to it. And so because the world clings to ignorance, Loka Sutta, we can't look to the world for answers, can we? Because the world is deluded. That's, again, what the Buddha awakened to. So all of the things, all the magical beliefs that were part of the Buddha's teaching and part of our time are simply part of the world. Even though they're taught as otherworldly and mystical and magical, they're part of the corruption of the world to be recognized as such and abandoned. Why? So we can live in reality. Another way of saying it a little bit more directly, maybe I'll get some people upset, is if we want to live in peace and harmony within ourselves, we have to recognize and abandon all the corruption that's in the world. And that can get pretty challenging for some people, depending on what you've attached yourself to in the past.
Yeah, which particular kind of corruption you have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And,
and that's the reason why I said we must be very gentle with ourselves. Because clinging to a corrupted view is not bad or wrong or sinful or hateful or anything else. What is it? What is clinging to fabricated beliefs, to ignorance? What is it? It's clinging to ignorance. That's
clinging.
All it is.
Clinging is clinging.
David.
And it's a normalization of the ignorance. So there's that cycle, samsara cycle, where there's a dullness that exists. And it only, when you enter into the practice, that it shakes your reality of what you're seeing. You see a glimpse of it, and that's why it's sometimes bothersome for practitioners. But then as you deepen your practice, it becomes more normal to see it more clearly. So you can see why the world is happy to go along with the ignorance. They don't think it's ignorance.
No, it's just,
they just think it's normal.
They think it's progress. We're on the verge of a new age of Aquarius. What was that? New age of Aquarius. And that's been a myth that's been perpetuated my entire life, probably long before that. Is right now today we're on the verge of a new dawning of consciousness, a great grand cosmic consciousness. I've been hearing that for 65 years. Mm-hmm. It hasn't happened yet. And I finally overcome the need to believe in it. And that's changed everything for me. It allowed me to find meaning right here and right now rather than when I get my reward. Whether it's a, and again, that's what David's talking about, that's what the Buddha's talking about. In a very gentle way, he's saying you made some wrong decisions. Those decisions were made without having all the information you need. And then he taught us the information we need, known as Four Noble Truths. And living from that standpoint, living from that point of understanding, there is no grasping, is there? Nothing could follow from that because there's no need in that type of mind. It's called freedom. Any other questions or comments about tonight's little, very well focused? I feel like Ram about this sutta, and I think, or this chapter. It's indicative of the entire Dhammapada, but this chapter, Bhikkhu Bhaga, to a monk, and then you read it and you listen to it and you realize what the Buddha was saying to that monk. It's just remarkable. Okay. I keep mentioning the Dhammapada. I think it's August 15th, which is a Saturday, will be our first class on the Dhammapada. There'll be 26 classes of that. And our new teachers are going to start teaching a little bit more during that series, too. So looking forward to that. We'll finish as we always do with metta. Kim, this is just another, I don't know, it's not really meditation, but I usually call it metta meditation. It's an intentional meditation. It's about the closest thing we get to prayer in Dhamma practice. It's not really, but it's simply stating this intention that is framed by the Dhamma. So gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths. Why is this doing that? Give me just a moment to scare it up. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining online. We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
See you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.